Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc, Volume 1. Book I and Dom Remy, Chapter 1. When Wolves Ran Free in Paris. I, the Sieur Louis de Conté, was born in Neufchâteau, on the 6th of January, 1410, that is to say, exactly 2 years before Joan of Arc was born in Dom Remy. My family had fled to those distant regions from the neighborhood of Paris in the first years of the century. In politics they were Armagnacs, patriots, they were for our own French king, crazy and impotent as he was. The Burgundian party, who were for the English, had stripped them, and done it well. They took everything but my father's small nobility, and when he reached Neufchâteau he reached it in poverty and with a broken spirit. But the political atmosphere there was the sort he liked, and that was something. He came to a region of comparative quiet, he left behind him a region peopled with furies, madmen, devils, where slaughter was a daily pastime and no man's life safe for a moment. In Paris, mobs roared through the streets nightly, sacking, burning, killing, unmolested, uninterrupted. The sun rose upon wrecked and smoking buildings, and upon mutilated corpses lying here, there, and yonder about the streets, just as they fell, and stripped naked by thieves, the unholy gleaners after the mob. None had the courage to gather these dead for burial, they were left there to rot and create plagues. And plagues they did create. Epidemics swept away the people like flies, and the burials were conducted secretly and by night, for public funerals were not allowed, lest the revelation of the magnitude of the plague's work unman the people and plunge them into despair. Then came, finally, the bitterest winter which had visited France in 500 years. Famine, pestilence, slaughter, ice, snow, Paris had all these at once. The dead lay in heaps about the streets, and wolves entered the city in daylight and devoured them. Ah, France had fallen low, so low. For more than three quarters of a century the English fangs had been bedded in her flesh, and so cowed had her armies become by ceaseless rout and defeat that it was said and accepted that the mere sight of an English army was sufficient to put a French one to flight. When I was 5 years old the prodigious disaster of Agincourt fell upon France, and although the English king went home to enjoy his glory, he left the country prostrate and a prey to roving bands of free companions in the service of the Burgundian party, and one of these bands came raiding through Neufchâteau one night, and by the light of our burning roof thatch I saw all that were dear to me in this world, save an elder brother, your ancestor, left behind with the court, butchered while they begged for mercy, and heard the butchers laugh at their prayers and mimic their pleadings. I was overlooked, and escaped without hurt. When the savages were gone I crept out and cried the night away watching the burning houses, and I was all alone, except for the company of the dead and the wounded, for the rest had taken flight and hidden themselves. I was sent to Dom Remy, to the priest, whose housekeeper became a loving mother to me. The priest, in the course of time, taught me to read and write, and he and I were the only persons in the village who possessed this learning. At the time that the house of this good priest, Guillaume Ferrante, became my home, I was 6 years old. We lived close by the village church, and the small garden of Joan's parents was behind the church. As to that family there were Jacques d'Arc the father, his wife Isabelle Romay, three sons, Jacques, 10 years old, Pierre, 8, and Jean, 7, Joan, 4, and her baby sister Catherine, about a year old. I had these children for playmates from the beginning. I had some other playmates besides, particularly four boys, Pierre Morel, Etienne Rose, Noel Rain-Gesson, and Edmund Aubry, whose father was mayor at that time, also two girls, about Joan's age, who by and by became her favorites. One was named Hometer, the other was called Little Mengat. These girls were common peasant children, like Joan herself. When they grew up, both married common laborers. Their estate was lowly enough, you see, yet a time came, many years after, when no passing stranger, howsoever great he might be, failed to go and pay his reverence to those two humble old women who had been honored in their youth by the friendship of Joan of Arc. These were all good children, just of the ordinary peasant type, not bright, of course, you would not expect that, but good-hearted and companionable, obedient to their parents and the priest, and as they grew up they became properly stocked with narrowness and prejudices got at second hand from their elders, and adopted without reserve, and without examination also, which goes without saying. Their religion was inherited, their politics the same. John Huss and his sort might find fault with the church, in Dom Remy it disturbed nobody's faith, and when the split came, when I was 14, and we had three popes at once, nobody in Dom Remy was worried about how to choose among them. The Pope of Rome was the right one, a pope outside of Rome was no pope at all. Every human creature in the village was an Armagnac, a patriot, and if we children hotly hated nothing else in the world, We did certainly hate the English and Burgundian name and polity in that way. Chapter 2: The Fairy Tree of Domrémy. Our Domrémy was like any other humble little hamlet of that remote time and region. It was a maze of crooked, narrow lanes and alleys shaded and sheltered by the overhanging thatch roofs of the barn-like houses. The houses were dimly lighted by wooden shuttered windows, that is, holes in the walls which served for windows. The floors were dirt, and there was very little furniture. Sheep and cattle grazing was the main industry. All the young folks tended flocks. The situation was beautiful. From one edge of the village a flowery plain extended in a wide sweep to the river, the Meuse. From the rear edge of the village a grassy slope rose gradually, and at the top was the great oak forest, a forest that was deep and gloomy and dense, and full of interest for us children, for many murders had been done in it by outlaws in old times, and in still earlier times prodigious dragons that spouted fire and poisonous vapors from their nostrils had their homes in there. In fact, one was still living in there in our own time. It was as long as a tree, and had a body as big around as a tierce, and scales like overlapping great tiles, and deep ruby eyes as large as a cavalier's hat, and an anchor fluke on its tail as big as I don't know what, but very big, even unusually so for a dragon, as everybody said who knew about dragons. It was thought that this dragon was of a brilliant blue color, with gold mottlings, but no one had ever seen it, therefore this was not known to be so, it was only an opinion. It was not my opinion. I think there is no sense in forming an opinion when there is no evidence to form it on. If you build a person without any bones in him, he may look fair enough to the eye, but he will be limber and cannot stand up, and I consider that evidence is the bones of an opinion. But I will take up this matter more at large at another time, and try to make the justness of my position appear. As to that dragon, I always held the belief that its color was gold and without blue, for that has always been the color of dragons. That this dragon lay but a little way within the wood at one time is shown by the fact that Pierre Morel was in there one day and smelled it, and recognized it by the smell. It gives one a horrid idea of how near to us the deadliest danger can be and we not suspect it. In the earliest times 100 knights from many remote places in the earth would have gone in there one after another, to kill the dragon and get the reward, but in our time that method had gone out, and the priest had become the one that abolished dragons. Pierre Guillaume Fronte did it in this case. He had a procession, with candles and incense and banners, and marched around the edge of the wood and exorcised the dragon, and it was never heard of again, although it was the opinion of many that the smell never wholly passed away. Not that any had ever smelt the smell again, for none had, it was only an opinion, like that other, and lacked bones, you see. I know that the creature was there before the exorcism, but whether it was there afterward or not is a thing which I cannot be so positive about. In a noble open space carpeted with grass on the high ground toward Vaucouleurs stood a most majestic beech tree with wide-reaching arms and a grand spread of shade, and by it a limpid spring of cold water, and on summer days the children went there, oh, every summer for more than 500 years, went there and sang and danced around the tree for hours together, refreshing themselves at the spring from time to time, and it was most lovely and enjoyable. Also they made wreaths of flowers and hung them upon the tree and about the spring to please the fairies that lived there. For they liked that, being idle innocent little creatures, as all fairies are, and fond of anything delicate and pretty like wild flowers put together in that way. And in return for this attention the fairies did any friendly thing they could for the children, such as keeping the spring always full and clear and cold, and driving away serpents and insects that sting, and so there was never any unkindness between the fairies and the children during more than 500 years, tradition said 1,000. But only the warmest affection and the most perfect trust and confidence, and whenever a child died the fairies mourned just as that child's playmates did, and the sign of it was there to see, for before the dawn on the day of the funeral they hung a little immortelle over the place where the child was used to sit under the tree. I know this to be true by my own eyes, it is not hearsay. And the reason it was known that the fairies did it was this, that it was made all of black flowers of a sort not known in France anywhere. Now from time immemorial all children reared in Domrémy were called the children of the tree, and they loved that name, for it carried with it a mystic privilege not granted to any others of the children of this world. Which was this, whenever one of these came to die, then beyond the vague and formless images drifting through his darkening mind rose soft and rich and fair a vision of the tree, if all was well with his soul. That was what some said. Others said the vision came in two ways, once as a warning, 1 or 2 years in advance of death, when the soul was the captive of sin, and then the tree appeared in its desolate winter aspect, then that soul was smitten with an awful fear. If repentance came, and purity of life, the vision came again, this time summer clad and beautiful, but if it were otherwise with that soul the vision was withheld, and it passed from life knowing its doom. Still others said that the vision came but once, and then only to the sinless dying forlorn in distant lands and pitifully longing for some last dear reminder of their home. And what reminder of it could go to their hearts like the picture of the tree that was the darling of their love and the comrade of their joys and comforter of their small griefs all through the divine days of their vanished youth. Now the several traditions were, as I have said, some believing one and some another. One of them I knew to be the truth, and that was the last one. I do not say anything against the others, I think they were true, but I only know that the last one was, and it is my thought that if one keep to the things he knows, and not trouble about the things which he cannot be sure about, he will have the steadier mind for it, and there is profit in that. I know that when the children of the tree die in a far land, then, if they be at peace with God, they turn their longing eyes toward home, and there, far shining, as through a rift in a cloud that curtains heaven, they see the soft picture of the fairy tree, clothed in a dream of golden light, and they see the bloomy mead sloping away to the river, and to their perishing nostrils is blown faint and sweet the fragrance of the flowers of home. And then the vision fades and passes, but they know, and by their transfigured faces you know also, you who stand looking on, yes, you know the message that has come, and that it has come from heaven. Joan and I believed alike about this matter. But Pierre Morel and Jacques d'Arc, and many others believed that the vision appeared twice, to a sinner. In fact, they and many others said they knew it. Probably because their fathers had known it and had told them, for one gets most things at second hand in this world. Now one thing that does make it quite likely that there were really two apparitions of the tree is this fact: from the most ancient times if one saw a villager of ours with his face ash white and rigid with a ghastly fright, it was common for everyone to whisper to his neighbor, "Ah, he is in sin, and has got his warning." And the neighbor would shudder at the thought and whisper back, "Yes, poor soul, he has seen the tree." Such evidences as these have their weight, they are not to be put aside with a wave of the hand. A thing that is backed by the cumulative evidence of centuries naturally gets nearer and nearer to being proof all the time, and if this continue and continue, it will someday become authority, and authority is a bedded rock, and will abide. In my long life I have seen several cases where the tree appeared announcing a death which was still far away, but in none of these was the person in a state of sin. No, the apparition was in these cases only a special grace, in place of deferring the tidings of that soul's redemption till the day of death. The apparition brought them long before, and with them peace, peace that might no more be disturbed, the eternal peace of God. I myself, old and broken, wait with serenity, for I have seen the vision of the tree. I have seen it, and am content. Always, from the remotest times, when the children joined hands and danced around the fairy tree, they sang a song which was the tree song, the song of L'Arbre Fille de Bourlamont. They sang it to a quaint sweet air, a solacing sweet air which has gone murmuring through my dreaming spirit all my life when I was weary and troubled, resting me and carrying me through night and distance home again. No stranger can know or feel what that song has been, through the drifting centuries, to exiled children of the tree, homeless and heavy of heart in countries foreign to their speech and ways. You will think it a simple thing, that song, and poor, perchance, but if you will remember what it was to us, and what it brought before our eyes when it floated through our memories, then you will respect it. And you will understand how the water wells up in our eyes and makes all things dim, and our voices break and we cannot sing the last lines. And when, in exile wandering, we shall fainting yearn for glimpse of thee, oh, rise upon our sight. And you will remember that Joan of Arc sang this song with us around the tree when she was a little child, and always loved it. And that hallows it, yes, you'll grant that. L'Arbre Fille de Bourlamont. Song of the Children. Now what has kept your leaves so green, Arbre Fille de Bourlamont? The children's tears. They brought each grief, and you did comfort them and cheer their bruised hearts, and steal a tear that, healed, rose a leaf. And what has built you up so strong, Arbre Fille de Bourlamont? The children's love. They've loved you long 100 years, in sooth, they've nourished you with praise and song, and warmed your heart and kept it young, 1,000 years of youth. Bide always green in our young hearts, Arbre Fille de Bourlamont. And we shall always youthful be, not heeding time his flight, and when, in exile wandering, we shall fainting yearn for glimpse of thee, oh, rise upon our sight. The fairies were still there when we were children, but we never saw them, because, 100 years before that, the priest of Domremy had held a religious function under the tree and denounced them as being blood-kin to the fiend and barred them from redemption, and then he warned them never to show themselves again, nor hang any more immortals, on pain of perpetual banishment from that parish. All the children pleaded for the fairies, and said they were their good friends and dear to them and never did them any harm, but the priest would not listen, and said it was sin and shame to have such friends. The children mourned and could not be comforted, and they made an agreement among themselves that they would always continue to hang flower wreaths on the tree as a perpetual sign to the fairies that they were still loved and remembered, though lost to sight. But late one night a great misfortune befell. Edmund Aubrey's mother passed by the tree, and the fairies were stealing a dance, not thinking anybody was by, and they were so busy, and so intoxicated with the wild happiness of it, and with the bumpers of dew sharpened up with honey which they had been drinking, that they noticed nothing. So Dame Aubrey stood there astonished and admiring, and saw the little fantastic atoms holding hands, as many as 300 of them, tearing around in a great ring half as big as an ordinary bedroom, and leaning away back and spreading their mouths with laughter and song, which she could hear quite distinctly, and kicking their legs up as much as 3 inches from the ground in perfect abandon and hilarity. Oh, the very maddest and witchingest dance the woman ever saw. But in about a minute or 2 minutes the poor little ruined creatures discovered her. They burst out in one heartbreaking squeak of grief and terror and fled every which way, with their wee hazelnut fists in their eyes and crying, and so disappeared. The heartless woman, no, the foolish woman, she was not heartless, but only thoughtless, went straight home and told the neighbors all about it, whilst we, the small friends of the fairies, were asleep and not witting the calamity that was come upon us, and all unconscious that we ought to be up and trying to stop these fatal tongues. In the morning everybody knew, and the disaster was complete. For where everybody knows a thing the priest knows it, of course. We all flocked to Pierfronte, crying and begging, and he had to cry, too, seeing our sorrow, for he had a most kind and gentle nature, and he did not want to banish the fairies, and said so, but said he had no choice, for it had been decreed that if they ever revealed themselves to man again, they must go. This all happened at the worst time possible, for Joan of Arc was ill of a fever and out of her head, and what could we do who had not her gifts of reasoning and persuasion? We flew in a swarm to her bed and cried out, "Joan, wake! Wake, there is no moment to lose. Come and plead for the fairies, come and save them, only you can do it." But her mind was wandering, she did not know what we said nor what we meant, so we went away knowing all was lost. Yes, all was lost, forever lost, the faithful friends of the children for 500 years must go, and never come back any more. It was a bitter day for us. That day that Pierfronte held the function under the tree and banished the fairies. We could not wear mourning that any could have noticed, it would not have been allowed, so we had to be content with some poor small rag of black tied upon our garments where it made no show, but in our hearts we wore mourning, big and noble and occupying all the room, for our hearts were ours, they could not get at them to prevent that. The great tree, L'Arbre Fée de Bourlemont was its beautiful name, was never afterward quiet as much to us as it had been before, but it was always dear, is dear to me yet when I go there now, once a year in my old age, to sit under it and bring back the lost playmates of my youth and group them about me and look upon their faces through my tears and break my heart, oh, my God! No, the place was not quite the same afterward. In one or two ways it could not be, for, the fairy's protection being gone, the spring lost much of its freshness and coldness, and more than 2/3 of its volume, and the banished serpents and stinging insects returned, and multiplied, and became a torment and have remained so to this day. When that wise little child, Joan, got well, we realized how much her illness had cost us, for we found that we had been right in believing she could save the fairies. She burst into a great storm of anger, for so little a creature, and went straight to Pierfronte, and stood up before him where he sat, and made reverence and said, "The fairies were to go if they showed themselves to people again, is it not so?" "Yes, that was it, dear. If a man comes prying into a person's room at midnight when that person is half naked, will you be so unjust as to say that that person is showing himself to that man?" "Well, no." The good priest looked a little troubled and uneasy when he said it. "Is a sin a sin, anyway, even if one did not intend to commit it?" Pierfronte threw up his hands and cried out, "Oh, my poor little child, I see all my fault," and he drew her to his side and put an arm around her and tried to make his peace with her. But her temper was up so high that she could not get it down right away, but buried her head against his breast and broke out crying and said, "Then the fairies committed no sin, for there was no intention to commit one, they not knowing that anyone was by, and because they were little creatures and could not speak for themselves and say the law was against the intention, not against the innocent act, because they had no friend to think that simple thing for them and say it, they have been sent away from their home forever, and it was wrong, wrong to do it." The good father hugged her yet closer to his side and said, "Oh, out of the mouths of babes and sucklings the heedless and unthinking are condemned, would God I could bring the little creatures back, for your sake. And mine, yes, and mine, for I have been unjust. There, There, don't cry, nobody could be sorrier than your poor old friend, don't cry, dear. But I can't stop right away, I've got to. And it is no little matter, this thing that you have done. Is being sorry penance enough for such an act? Pierre Franti turned away his face, for it would have hurt her to see him laugh, and said, "Oh, thou remorseless but most just accuser, no, it is not. I will put on sackcloth and ashes, there, are you satisfied?" Joan's sobs began to diminish, and she presently looked up at the old man through her tears, and said, in her simple way, "Yes, that will do, if it will clear you." Pierre Franti would have been moved to laugh again, perhaps, if he had not remembered in time that he had made a contract, and not a very agreeable one. It must be fulfilled. So he got up and went to the fireplace, Joan watching him with deep interest, and took a shovelful of cold ashes, and was going to empty them on his old gray head when a better idea came to him, and he said, "Would you mind helping me, dear?"
"How, father?"
He got down on his knees and bent his head low, and said, "Take the ashes and put them on my head for me." The matter ended there, of course. The victory was with the priest. One can imagine how the idea of such a profanation would strike Joan or any other child in the village. She ran and dropped upon her knees by his side and said, "Oh, it is dreadful. I didn't know that that was what one meant by sackcloth and ashes. Do please get up, father." "But I can't until I am forgiven. Do you forgive me?"
"I?
Oh, you have done nothing to me, father, it is yourself that must forgive yourself for wronging those poor things. Please get up, father, won't you? But I am worse off now than I was before. I thought I was earning your forgiveness, but if it is my own, I can't be lenient, it would not become me. Now what can I do? Find me some way out of this with your wise little head." The peer would not stir, for all Joan's pleadings. She was about to cry again, then she had an idea, and seized the shovel and deluged her own head with the ashes, stammering out through her chokings and suffocations, "There, now it is done. Oh, please get up, father." The old man, both touched and amused, gathered her to his breast and said, "Oh, you incomparable child. It's a humble martyrdom, and not of a sort presentable in a picture, but the right and true spirit is in it, that I testify." Then he brushed the ashes out of her hair, and helped her scour her face and neck and properly tidy herself up. He was in fine spirits now, and ready for further argument, so he took his seat and drew Joan to his side again, and said, "Joan, you were used to make wreaths there at the fairy tree with the other children, is it not so?" That was the way he always started out when he was going to corner me up and catch me in something, just that gentle, indifferent way that fools a person so, and leads him into the trap, he never noticing which way he is traveling until he is in and the door shut on him. He enjoyed that. I knew he was going to drop corn along in front of Joan now. Joan answered, "Yes, father."
"Did you hang them on the tree?"
"No, father."
"Didn't hang them there?"
"No."
"Why didn't you?"
I didn't wish to."
"Didn't wish to?"
"No, father."
"What did you do with them?"
"I hung them in the church."
"Why didn't you want to hang them in the tree?"
"Because it was said that the fairies were of kin to the fiend, and that it was sinful to show them honor."
"Did you believe it was wrong to honor them so?"
"Yes. I thought it must be wrong."
"Then if it was wrong to honor them in that way, and if they were of kin to the fiend, they could be dangerous company for you and the other children, couldn't they?"
"I suppose so, yes, I think so." He studied a minute, and I judged he was going to spring his trap, and he did. He said, "Then the matter stands like this. They were banned creatures, of fearful origin, they could be dangerous company for the children. Now give me a rational reason, dear, if you can think of any, why you call it a wrong to drive them into banishment, and why you would have saved them from it. In a word, what loss have you suffered by it?" How stupid of him to go and throw his case away like that. I could have boxed his ears for vexation if he had been a boy. He was going along all right until he ruined everything by winding up in that foolish and fatal way. What had she lost by it? Was he never going to find out what kind of a child Joan of Arc was? Was he never going to learn that things which merely concerned her own gain or loss she cared nothing about? Could he never get the simple fact into his head that the sure way and the only way to rouse her up and set her on fire was to show her where some other person was going to suffer wrong or hurt or loss? Why, he had gone and set a trap for himself, that was all he had accomplished. The minute those words were out of his mouth her temper was up, the indignant tears rose in her eyes, and she burst out on him with an energy and passion which astonished him, but didn't astonish me,
for I knew he had fired a mine when he touched off his ill-chosen climax.
Oh, father, how can you talk like that? Who owns France?
God and the king.
Not Satan?
Satan, my child? This is the footstool of the Most High, Satan owns no handful of its soil.
Then who gave those poor creatures their home?
God.
Who protected them in it all those centuries?
God.
Who allowed them to dance and play there all those centuries and found no fault with it?
God.
Who disapproved of God's approval and put a threat upon them?
A man.
Who caught them again in harmless sports that God allowed and a man forbade, and carried out that threat, and drove the poor things away from the home the good God gave them in His mercy and His pity, and sent down His rain and dew and sunshine upon it 500 years in token of His peace. It was their home, theirs, by the grace of God and His good heart, and no man had a right to rob them of it. And they were the gentlest, truest friends that children ever had, and did them sweet and loving service all these 5 long centuries, and never any hurt or harm, and the children loved them, and now they mourn for them, and there is no healing for their grief. And what had the children done that they should suffer this cruel stroke? The poor fairies could have been dangerous company for the children?
Yes, but never had been, and could is no argument.
Kinsmen of the fiend?
What of it?
Kinsmen of the fiend have rights, and these had, and children have rights, and these had, and if I had been there I would have spoken, I would have begged for the children and the fiends, and stayed your hand and saved them all. But now, oh, now, all is lost, everything is lost, and there is no help more.
Then she finished with a blast at that idea that fairy kinsmen of the fiend ought to be shunned and denied human sympathy and friendship because salvation was barred against them. She said that for that very reason people ought to pity them, and do every humane and loving thing they could to make them forget the hard fate that had been put upon them by accident of birth and no fault of their own.
Poor little creatures! She said. What can a person's heart be made of that can pity a Christian's child and yet can't pity a devil's child, that 1,000 times more needs it? She had torn loose from Pierfronte, and was crying, with her knuckles in her eyes, and stamping her small feet in a fury, and now she burst out of the place and was gone before we could gather our senses together out of this storm of words and this whirlwind of passion. The peer had got upon his feet, toward the last, and now he stood there passing his hand back and forth across his forehead like a person who is dazed and troubled. Then he turned and wandered toward the door of his little workroom, and as he passed through it I heard him murmur sorrowfully.
Ah, me, poor children, poor fiends, they have rights, and she said true, I never thought of that. God forgive me. I am to blame. When I heard that, I knew I was right in the thought that he had set a trap for himself. It was so, and he had walked into it, you see. I seemed to feel encouraged, and wondered if mayhap I might get him into one, but upon reflection my heart went down, for this was not my gift.
Chapter 3 All Aflame with Love of France. Speaking of this matter reminds me of many incidents, many things that I could tell, but I think I will not try to do it now. It will be more to my present humor to call back a little glimpse of the simple and colorless good times we used to have in our village homes in those peaceful days, especially in the winter. In the summer we children were out on the breezy uplands with the flocks from dawn till night, and then there was noisy frolicking and all that. But winter was the cozy time, winter was the snug time. Often we gathered in old Jacques d'Arc's big dirt-floored apartment, with a great fire going, and played games, and sang songs, and told fortunes, and listened to the old villagers tell tales and histories and lies and one thing and another till 12 o'clock at night. One winter's night we were gathered there, it was the winter that for years afterward they called the hard winter, and that particular night was a sharp one. It blew a gale outside, and the screaming of the wind was a stirring sound, and I think I may say it was beautiful, for I think it is great and fine and beautiful to hear the wind rage and storm and blow its clarions like that, when you are inside and comfortable. And we were. We had a roaring fire, and the pleasant spit-spit of the snow and sleet falling in it down the chimney, and the yarning and laughing and singing went on at a noble rate till about 10 o'clock, and then we had a supper of hot porridge and beans, and meal cakes with butter, and appetites to match. Little Joan sat on a box apart, and had her bowl and bread on another one, and her pets around her helping. She had more than was usual of the more economical, because all the outcast cats came and took up with her, and homeless or unlovable animals of other kinds heard about it and came. And these spread the matter to the other creatures, and they came also, and as the birds and the other timid wild things of the woods were not afraid of her, but always had an idea she was a friend when they came across her, and generally struck up an acquaintance with her to get invited to the house, she always had samples of those breeds in stock. She was hospitable to them all, for an animal was an animal to her, and dear by mere reason of being an animal, no matter about its sort or social station, and as she would allow of no cages,
no collars, no fetters, but left the creatures free to come and go as they liked, that contented them, and they came, but they didn't go, to any extent, and so they were a marvelous nuisance, and made Jacques d'Arc swear a good deal, but his wife said God gave the child the instinct, and knew what he was doing when he did it, therefore it must have its course, it would be no sound prudence to meddle with his affairs when no invitation had been extended. So the pets were left in peace, and here they were, as I have said, rabbits, birds, squirrels, cats, and other reptiles, all around the child, and full of interest in her supper, and helping what they could. There was a very small squirrel on her shoulder, sitting up, as those creatures do, and turning a rocky fragment of prehistoric chestnut cake over and over in its knotty hands, and hunting for the less indurated places, and giving its elevated bushy tail a flirt and its pointed ears a toss when it found one, signifying thankfulness and surprise, and then it filed that place off with those two slender front teeth which a squirrel carries for that purpose and not for ornament, for ornamental they never could be, as any will admit that have noticed them. Everything was going fine and breezy and hilarious, but then there came an interruption, for somebody hammered on the door. It was one of those ragged road stragglers, the eternal wars kept the country full of them. He came in, all over snow, and stamped his feet, and shook, and brushed himself, and shut the door, and took off his limp ruin of a hat, and slapped it once or twice against his leg to knock off its fleece of snow, and then glanced around on the company with a pleased look upon his thin face, and a most yearning and famished one in his eye when it fell upon the victuals, and then he gave us a humble and conciliatory salutation, and said it was a blessed thing to have a fire like that on such a night, and a roof overhead like this, and that rich food to eat, and loving friends to talk with. Ah, yes, this was true, and God help the homeless, and such as must trudge the roads in this weather. Nobody said anything. The embarrassed poor creature stood there and appealed to one face after the other with his eyes, and found no welcome in any, the smile on his own face flickering and fading and perishing, meanwhile, then he dropped his gaze, the muscles of his face began to twitch, and he put up his hand to cover this womanish sign of weakness. Sit down. This thunder blast was from old Jacques d'Arc, and Joan was the object of it. The stranger was startled, and took his hand away, and there was Joan standing before him offering him her bowl of porridge. The man said, God Almighty bless you, my darling. And then the tears came, and ran down his cheeks, but he was afraid to take the bowl. Do you hear me? Sit down, I say. There could not be a child more easy to persuade than Joan, but this was not the way. Her father had not the art, neither could he learn it. Joan said, Father, he is hungry, I can see it. Let him work for food, then. We are being eaten out of house and home by his like, and I have said I would endure it no more, and will keep my word. He has the face of a rascal anyhow, and a villain. Sit down, I tell you. I know not if he is a rascal or no, but he is hungry, father, and shall have my porridge, I do not need it. If you don't obey me rascals are not entitled to help from honest people, and no bite nor sup shall they have in this house. Joan. She set her bowl down on the box and came over and stood before her scowling father, and said, Father, if you will not let me, then it must be as you say, but I would that you would think, then you would see that it is not right to punish one part of him for what the other part has done, for it is that poor stranger's head that does the evil things, but it is not his head that is hungry, it is his stomach, and it has done no harm to anybody, but is without blame, and innocent, not having any way to do a wrong, even if it was minded to it. Please let. What an idea! It is the most idiotic speech I ever heard. But Aubrey, the mayor, broke in, he being fond of an argument, and having a pretty gift in that regard, as all acknowledged. Rising in his place and leaning his knuckles upon the table and looking about him with easy dignity, after the manner of such as be orders, he began, smooth and persuasive. I will differ with you there, gossip, and will undertake to show the company here. He looked around upon us and nodded his head in a confident way, that there is a grain of sense in what the child has said, for look you, it is of a certainty most true and demonstrable that it is a man's head that is master and supreme ruler over his whole body. Is that granted? Will any deny it? He glanced around again, everybody indicated assent. Very well, then, that being the case, no part of the body is responsible for the result when it carries out an order delivered to it by the head, ergo, the head is alone responsible for crimes done by a man's hands or feet or stomach, do you get the idea? Am I right thus far? Everybody said yes, and said it with enthusiasm, and some said, one to another, that the mayor was in great form tonight and at his very best, which pleased the mayor exceedingly and made his eyes sparkle with pleasure, for he overheard these things, So he went on in the same fertile and brilliant way. Now, then, we will consider what the term responsibility means, and how it affects the case in point. Responsibility makes a man responsible for only those things for which he is properly responsible, and he waved his spoon around in a wide sweep to indicate the comprehensive nature of that class of responsibilities which render people responsible, and several exclaimed, admiringly, "He is right. He has put that whole tangled thing into a nutshell. It is wonderful." After a little pause to give the interest opportunity to gather and grow, he went on, "Very good. Let us suppose the case of a pair of tongs that falls upon a man's foot, causing a cruel hurt. Will you claim that the tongs are punishable for that?" The question is answered, "I see by your faces that you would call such a claim absurd. Now, why is it absurd?" "It is absurd because, there being no reasoning faculty, that is to say, no faculty of personal command, in a pair of tongs, personal responsibility for the acts of the tongs is wholly absent from the tongs, and, therefore, responsibility being absent, punishment cannot ensue. Am I right?" A hearty burst of applause was his answer. "Now, then, we arrive at a man's stomach. Consider how exactly, how marvelously, indeed, its situation corresponds to that of a pair of tongs. Listen, and take careful note, I beg you. Can a man's stomach plan a murder? No. Can it plan a theft? No. Can it plan an incendiary fire? No. Now answer me, can a pair of tongs?" There were admiring shouts of no. "And the cases are just exact. And don't he do it splendid?" "Now, then, friends and neighbors, a stomach which cannot plan a crime cannot be a principal in the commission of it, that is plain, as you see. The matter is narrowed down by that much, we will narrow it further. Can a stomach, of its own motion, assist at a crime?" The answer is no, because command is absent, the reasoning faculty is absent, volition is absent, as in the case of the tongs. We perceive now, do we not, that the stomach is totally irresponsible for crimes committed, either in whole or in part, by it? He got a rousing cheer for a response. Then what do we arrive at as our verdict? Clearly this, that there is no such thing in this world as a guilty stomach, that in the body of the veriest rascal resides a pure and innocent stomach, that, whatever its owner may do, it at least should be sacred in our eyes, and that while God gives us minds to think just and charitable and honorable thoughts, it should be, and is, our privilege, as well as our duty, not only to feed the hungry stomach that resides in a rascal, having pity for its sorrow and its need, but to do it gladly, gratefully, in recognition of its sturdy and loyal maintenance of its purity and innocence in the midst of temptation and in company so repugnant to its better feelings. I am done. Well, you never saw such an effect. They rose, the whole house rose, and clapped, and cheered, and praised him to the skies, and one after another, still clapping and shouting, they crowded forward, some with moisture in their eyes, and wrung his hands, and said such glorious things to him that he was clear overcome with pride and happiness, and couldn't say a word, for his voice would have broken, sure. It was splendid to see, and everybody said he had never come up to that speech in his life before, and never could do it again. Eloquence is a power, there is no question of that. Even old Jacques d'Arc was carried away, for once in his life, and shouted out, "It's all right, Joan, give him the porridge." She was embarrassed, and did not seem to know what to say, and so didn't say anything. It was because she had given the man the porridge long ago and he had already eaten it all up. When she was asked why she had not waited until a decision was arrived at, she said the man's stomach was very hungry, and it would not have been wise to wait, since she could not tell what the decision would be. Now that was a good and thoughtful idea for a child. The man was not a rascal at all. He was a very good fellow, only he was out of luck, and surely that was no crime at that time in France. Now that his stomach was proved to be innocent, it was allowed to make itself at home, and as soon as it was well filled and needed nothing more, the man unwound his tongue and turned it loose, and it was really a noble one to go. He had been in the wars for years, and the things he told and the way he told them fired everybody's patriotism away up high, and set all hearts to thumping and all pulses to leaping. Then, before anybody rightly knew how the change was made, he was leading us a sublime march through the ancient glories of France, and in fancy we saw the titanic forms of the 12 paladins rise out of the mists of the past and face their fate. We heard the tread of the innumerable hosts sweeping down to shut them in. We saw this human tide flow and ebb and flow, and waste away before that little band of heroes. We saw each detail pass before us of that most stupendous, most disastrous, yet most adored and glorious day in French legendary history. Here and there and yonder, across that vast field of the dead and dying, we saw this and that and the other paladin dealing his prodigious blows with weary arm and failing strength, and one by one we saw them fall, till only one remained, he that was without peer, he whose name gives name to the Song of Songs, the song which no Frenchman can hear and keep his feelings down and his pride of country cool. Then, grandest and pitifulest scene of all, we saw his own pathetic death, and our stillness, as we sat with parted lips and breathless, hanging upon this man's words, gave us a sense of the awful stillness that reigned in that field of slaughter when that last surviving soul had passed. And now, in this solemn hush, the stranger gave Joan a pat or two on the head and said, "Little maid, whom God keep. You have brought me from death to life this night, now listen, here is your reward," and at that supreme time for such a heart-melting, soul-rousing surprise, without another word he lifted up the most noble and pathetic voice that was ever heard, and began to pour out the great song of Roland. Think of that, with a French audience all stirred up and ready. Oh, where was your spoken eloquence now? What was it to this? How fine he looked, how stately, how inspired, as he stood there with that mighty chant welling from his lips and his heart, his whole body transfigured, and his rags along with it. Everybody rose and stood while he sang, and their faces glowed and their eyes burned, and the tears came and flowed down their cheeks and their forms began to sway unconsciously to the swing of the song, and their bosoms to heave and pant, and moanings broke out, and deep ejaculations, and when the last verse was reached, and Roland lay dying, all alone, with his face to the field and to his slain, lying there in heaps and winrows, and took off and held up his gauntlet to God with his failing hand, and breathed his beautiful prayer with his paling pips, all burst out in sobs and wailings. But when the final great note died out and the song was done, they all flung themselves in a body at the singer, stark mad with love of him and love of France and pride in her great deeds and old renown, and smothered him with their embracings. But Joan was there first, hugged close to his breast, and covering his face with idolatrous kisses. The storm raged on outside, but that was no matter, this was the stranger's home now, for as long as he might please. Chapter 4 Joan tames the madman. All children have nicknames, and we had ours. We got one apiece early, and they stuck to us, but Joan was richer in this matter, for, as time went on, she earned a second, and then a third, and so on, and we gave them to her. First and last she had as many as half a dozen. Several of these she never lost. Peasant girls are bashful naturally, but she surpassed the rule so far, and colored so easily, and was so easily embarrassed in the presence of strangers, that we nicknamed her the Bashful. We were all patriots, but she was called the Patriot, because our warmest feeling for our country was cold beside hers. Also she was called the Beautiful, and this was not merely because of the extraordinary beauty of her face and form, but because of the loveliness of her character. These names she kept, and one other, the Brave. We grew along up, in that plodding and peaceful region, and got to be good-sized boys and girls, big enough, in fact, to begin to know as much about the wars raging perpetually to the west and north of us as our elders, and also to feel as stirred up over the occasional news from these red fields as they did. I remember certain of these days very clearly. One Tuesday a crowd of us were romping and singing around the fairy tree, and hanging garlands on it in memory of our lost little fairy friends, when little Mingot cried out, "Look! What is that?" When one exclaims like that in a way that shows astonishment and apprehension, he gets attention. All the panting breasts and flushed faces flock together, and all the eager eyes were turned in one direction, down the slope, toward the village. "It's a black flag." "A black flag? No, is it? You can see for yourself that it is nothing else." "It is a black flag, sure. Now, has any ever seen the like of that before? What can it mean?" "Mean? It means something dreadful. What else?" "That is nothing to the point, anybody knows that without the telling." "But what?" "That is the question." "It is a chance that he that bears it can answer as well as any that are here, if you contain yourself till he comes." "He runs well. Who is it?" Some named one, some another, but presently all saw that it was Etienne Rose, called the Sunflower, because he had yellow hair and a round pockmarked face. His ancestors had been German some centuries ago. He came straining up the slope, now and then projecting his flagstick aloft and giving his black symbol of woe a wave in the air, whilst all eyes watched him, all tongues discussed him, and every heart beat faster and faster with impatience to know his news. At last he sprang among us, and struck his flagstick into the ground, saying, "There. Stand there and represent France while I get my breath. She needs no other flag now." All the giddy chatter stopped. It was as if one had announced a death. In that chilly hush there was no sound audible but the panting of the breath-blown boy. When he was presently able to speak, he said, "Black news has come. A treaty has been made at Troyes between France and the English and Burgundians. By it France is betrayed and delivered over, tied hand and foot, to the enemy. It is the work of the Duke of Burgundy and that she devil, the Queen of France. It marries Henry of England to Catherine of France. Is not this a lie? Marries the daughter of France to the butcher of Agincourt? It is not to be believed. You have not heard aright. If you cannot believe that, Jacques d'Arc, then you have a difficult task indeed before you, for worse is to come. Any child that is born of that marriage, if even a girl, is to inherit the thrones of both England and France, and this double ownership is to remain with its posterity forever. Now that is certainly a lie, for it runs counter to our Salic law, and so is not legal and cannot have effect, said Edmund Aubrey, called the Paladin, because of the armies he was always going to eat up some day. He would have said more, but he was drowned out by the clamors of the others, who all burst into a fury over this feature of the treaty, all talking at once and nobody hearing anybody, until presently Haumette persuaded them to be still, saying, "It is not fair to break him up so in his tale, pray let him go on. You find fault with his history because it seems to be lies. That were reason for satisfaction, that kind of lies, not discontent. Tell the rest, Etienne. There is but this to tell, our king, Charles VI, is to reign until he dies, then Henry V. of England is to be regent of France until a child of his shall be old enough to. That man is to reign over us, the butcher? It is lies. All lies," cried the Paladin. "Besides, look you, what becomes of our Dauphin? What says the treaty about him? Nothing. It takes away his throne and makes him an outcast." Then everybody shouted at once and said the news was a lie, and all began to get cheerful again, saying, "Our king would have to sign the treaty to make it good, and that he would not do, seeing how it serves his own son." But the Sunflower said, "I will ask you this, would the queen sign a treaty disinheriting her son? That viper? Certainly. Nobody is talking of her. Nobody expects better of her. There is no villainy she will stick at, if it feed her spite, and she hates her son. Her signing it is of no consequence. The king must sign. I will ask you another thing. What is the king's condition? Mad, isn't he? Yes, and his people love him all the more for it. It brings him near to them by his sufferings, and pitying him makes them love him. You say right, Jacques d'Arc. Well, what would you of one that is mad? Does he know what he does? No. Does he do what others make him do? Yes. Now, then, I tell you he has signed the treaty. Who made him do it? You know, without my telling. The queen." Then there was another uproar, everybody talking at once, and all heaping execrations upon the queen's head. Finally Jacques d'Arc said, "But many reports come that are not true. Nothing so shameful as this has ever come before. Nothing that cuts so deep, nothing that has dragged France so low, therefore there is hope that this tale is but another idle rumor. Where did you get it?" The color went out of his sister Joan's face. She dreaded the answer, and her instinct was right. "The cure of Maxie brought it." There was a general gasp. "We knew him, you see, for a trusty man. Did he believe it?" The hearts almost stopped beating. Then came the answer. "He did. And that is not all. He said he knew it to be true." Some of the girls began to sob, the boys were struck silent. The distress in Joan's face was like that which one sees in the face of a dumb animal that has received a mortal hurt. The animal bears it, making no complaint, she bore it also, saying no word. Her brother Jacques put his hand on her head and caressed her hair to indicate his sympathy, and she gathered the hand to her lips and kissed it for thanks, not saying anything. Presently the reaction came, and the boys began to talk. Noel Rainguesson said, "Oh, are we never going to be men? We do grow along so slowly, and France never needed soldiers as she needs them now, to wipe out this black insult." "I hate youth," said Pierre Morel, called the Dragonfly because his eyes stuck out so. "You've always got to wait, and wait, and wait, and here are the great wars wasting away for 100 years, and you never get a chance. If I could only be a soldier now." "As for me, I'm not going to wait much longer," said the Paladin, "and when I do start you'll hear from me, I promise you that. There are some who, in storming a castle, prefer to be in the rear, but as for me, give me the front or none, I will have none in front of me but the officers." Even the girls got the war spirit, and Marie Dupont said, "I would I were a man, I would start this minute," and looked very proud of herself, and glanced about for applause. "So would I," said Cecile Letellier, sniffing the air like a warhorse that smells the battle, I warrant you I would not turn back from the field though all England were in front of me.
Pooh! Said the paladin, girls can brag, but that's all they are good for. Let 1,000 of them come face to face with a handful of soldiers once, if you want to see what running is like. Here's little Joan. Next she'll be threatening to go for a soldier.
The idea was so funny, and got such a good laugh, that the paladin gave it another trial, and said, why you can just see her. See her plunge into battle like any old veteran.
Yes, indeed, and not a poor shabby common soldier like us, but an officer, mind you, with armor on, and the bars of a steel helmet to blush behind and hide her embarrassment when she finds an army in front of her that she hasn't been introduced to.
An officer? Why, she'll be a captain.
A captain, I tell you, with 100 men at her back, or maybe girls.
Oh, no common soldier business for her.
And, dear me, when she starts for that other army, you'll think there's a hurricane blowing it away.
Well, he kept it up like that till he made their sides ache with laughing, which was quite natural, for certainly it was a very funny idea, at that time, I mean, the idea of that gentle little creature, that wouldn't hurt a fly, and couldn't bear the sight of blood, and was so girlish and shrinking in all ways, rushing into battle with a gang of soldiers at her back.
Poor thing, she sat there confused and ashamed to be so laughed at. And yet at that very minute there was something about to happen which would change the aspect of things, and make those young people see that when it comes to laughing, the person that laughs last has the best chance. For just then a face which we all knew and all feared projected itself from behind the fairy tree, and the thought that shot through us all was, crazy Benoist has gotten loose from his cage, and we are as good as dead. This ragged and hairy and horrible creature glided out from behind the tree, and raised an axe as he came. We all broke and fled, this way and that. The girl screaming and crying.
No, not all, all but Joan. She stood up and faced the man, and remained so. As we reached the wood that borders the grassy clearing and jumped into its shelter, two or three of us glanced back to see if Benoist was gaining on us, and that is what we saw, Joan standing, and the maniac gliding stealthily toward her with his axe lifted. The sight was sickening. We stood where we were, trembling and not able to move. I did not want to see the murder done, and yet I could not take my eyes away. Now I saw Joan step forward to meet the man, though I believed my eyes must be deceiving me. Then I saw him stop. He threatened her with his axe, as if to warn her not to come further, but she paid no heed, but went steadily on, until she was right in front of him, right under his axe. Then she stopped, and seemed to begin to talk with him. It made me sick, yes, giddy, and everything swam around me, and I could not see anything for a time, whether long or brief I do not know. When this passed and I looked again, Joan was walking by the man's side toward the village, holding him by his hand. The axe was in her other hand. One by one the boys and girls crept out, and we stood there gazing, open-mouthed, till those two entered the village and were hid from sight. It was then that we named her the Brave. We left the black flag there to continue its mournful office, for we had other matter to think of now. We started for the village on a run, to give warning, and get Joan out of her peril, though for one, after seeing what I had seen, it seemed to me that while Joan had the axe the man's chance was not the best of the two. When we arrived the danger was past, the madman was in custody. All the people were flocking to the little square in front of the church to talk and exclaim and wonder over the event, and it even made the town forget the black news of the treaty for 2 or 3 hours. All the women kept hugging and kissing Joan, and praising her, and crying, and the men patted her on the head and said they wished she was a man. They would send her to the wars and never doubt but that she would strike some blows that would be heard of. She had to tear herself away and go and hide, this glory was so trying to her diffidence. Of course the people began to ask us for the particulars. I was so ashamed that I made an excuse to the first comer, and got privately away and went back to the fairy tree, to get relief from the embarrassment of those questionings. There I found Joan, but she was there to get relief from the embarrassment of glory. One by one the others shirked the inquirers and joined us in our refuge. Then we gathered around Joan, and asked her how she had dared to do that thing. She was very modest about it, and said, "You make a great thing of it, but you mistake, it was not a great matter. It was not as if I had been a stranger to the man. I know him, and have known him long, and he knows me, and likes me. I have fed him through the bars of his cage many times, and last December, when they chopped off 2 of his fingers to remind him to stop seizing and wounding people passing by, I dressed his hand every day till it was well again." "That is all well enough," said little Mengat, "but he is a madman, dear, and so his likings and his gratitude and friendliness go for nothing when his rage is up. You did a perilous thing."
"Of course you did," said the sunflower.
Didn't he threaten to kill you with the axe?
Yes.
Didn't he threaten you more than once?
Yes.
Didn't you feel afraid?
No, at least not much, very little.
Why didn't you?
She thought a moment, then said, quite simply.
I don't know.
It made everybody laugh. Then the sunflower said it was like a lamb trying to think out how it had come to eat a wolf, but had to give it up.
Cecilia Tellier asked, why didn't you run when we did?
Because it was necessary to get him to his cage, else he would kill someone. Then he would come to the like harm himself.
It is noticeable that this remark, which implies that Joan was entirely forgetful of herself and her own danger, and had thought and wrought for the preservation of other people alone, was not challenged, or criticized, or commented upon by anybody there, but was taken by all as matter of course and true. It shows how clearly her character was defined, and how well it was known and established.
There was silence for a time, and perhaps we were all thinking of the same thing, namely, what a poor figure we had cut in that adventure as contrasted with Joan's performance. I tried to think up some good way of explaining why I had run away and left a little girl at the mercy of a maniac armed with an axe, but all of the explanations that offered themselves to me seemed so cheap and shabby that I gave the matter up and remained still. But others were less wise. Noel Rangesson fidgeted a while, then broke out with a remark which showed what his mind had been running on.
The fact is, I was taken by surprise. That is the reason. If I had had a moment to think, I would no more have thought of running than I would think of running from a baby. For, after all, what is Théophile Benoist, that I should seem to be afraid of him?
Pooh! The idea of being afraid of that poor thing! I only wish he would come along now, I'd show you.
So do I! Cried Pierre Morel. If I wouldn't make him climb this tree quicker than, well, you'd see what I would do. Taking a person by surprise, that way, why, I never meant to run, not in earnest, I mean. I never thought of running in earnest, I only wanted to have some fun. And when I saw Joan standing there, and him threatening her, it was all I could do to restrain myself from going there and just tearing the livers and lights out of him. I wanted to do it bad enough, and if it was to do over again,